The trial and the death of Jesus reveal both the wicked heart of man and the gracious heart of God. I want you to consider that statement for a few moments. The trial of Jesus, and that's where we'll focus this morning, the trials that Jesus went through, really mockery of trials, but also leading up to his crucifixion, because they all happen on the same day according to the way the Jews kept time. From sunset on what we would call Thursday evening to sunset of the following Friday, that 24-hour period would be considered Friday to the Jews. And all these things that we're going to be discussing this morning happened during that time span, leading up to when Jesus would be nailed to the cross. Jesus is going to encounter many people in many different situations. But as we explore this together, remember how these trials would reveal the wicked heart of man, but also the great gracious heart of God. It was nighttime. It was the sixth day of the greatest week in history, sometime early Friday before dawn. This is after Jesus had gone into the garden to pray. This is after Judas had come in and betrayed our Lord with a kiss. This is after he's been arrested and they take him to the house of the high priest. If you'll be opening your Bibles to Luke 22, we'll be looking at the last part of that chapter and into the first few verses of Luke chapter 23. But first of all, at the house of the high priest, and this outside of which is where Peter will be warming himself by the fires of the enemies of Christ and would deny him three times. What's going on the inside? Verse 54 of Luke 22, having arrested Jesus, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance. John tells us that first they led him away to Annas, who was the former high priest, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the current high priest. Caiaphas was appointed high priest by the Romans. He has been described as domineering, unscrupulous, and criminal. He had earlier joined in a conspiracy to see Jesus dead. So there's the motivation for this meeting during the night or the wee hours of the morning concerning Jesus. He's merely trying to get a precise charge against Jesus. He wants Jesus out of the way. He wants Jesus killed. But he has to figure out a way to do it where it'll look legal. There's nothing legal about this trial. I use that in quotation marks in the house of the high priest. It was illegal, in fact. According to the Jews' laws, trials could not be held at night. Verdicts could not be rendered on the same day as the trial. Sentences could not be imposed on the same day they were given. And every one of those that I just mentioned are violated. This is a mockery of a trial. Caiaphas wants to find something that he can pin on Jesus that will make him worthy of death. And so they conjure up these false witnesses, but their testimony doesn't agree. And so Caiaphas takes it upon himself and asks Jesus, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus responds, "I am." And Caiaphas erupts. He says, "You've heard him from his own lips say that he is the Son of the Blessed One. You've heard him speak blasphemy," and they all condemned him to be deserving of death. They accused him of blasphemy, speaking against Jehovah God. And according to the law of Moses, blasphemy was to be punished by death, by stoning. But you see, they didn't have the right. They didn't have the right to punish capital crimes by death. But anyway, this trial was illegal to begin with. They knew that they could not formulate the charge. They couldn't pass sentence because they weren't even supposed to be meeting like this. And so they gave him to the temple guards. And Luke tells us in 63 and following of Luke chapter 22. Now the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. And having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who struck you? And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. Mark tells us that they spit on him, that they beat him, and they struck him with the palms of their hands. As I was thinking about that statement in Mark 14:65, with the palms of their hands, I think this was more than just a slap. With the palms of the hands would be brute force that would knock Jesus over. These trials would show the wickedness of man, but the gracious heart of God. So that illegal trial ends. And then Jesus is taken before the Sanhedrin. Luke 22 verse 66 says, as soon as it was day. Now they have the right to convene. But interestingly, this is on the day of Passover. But they're convening. Even on this Jewish holiday, this revered holiday. But they want Jesus. They're so defiant against him and want him executed that they're meeting on this day. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, chief priests and scribes came together and led him into their council. This was the great Sanhedrin, the highest Jewish court. 70 members presided over by the high priest, Caiaphas himself. And there are no witnesses brought in on this day. They're not interested in true justice. In fact, they get to the point. Verse 67, if you are the Christ, tell us. But Jesus said to them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. And so they caught that term, Son of Man. They knew that was used to describe the Messiah. And so they ask, are you then the Son of God? And he said to them, you rightly say that I am. And they said, what further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. Again, blasphemy was the charge. He's making himself equal with God. And so Jesus was guilty, they believed, of this sin and deserved to die. But a death sentence had to be ratified by the Romans. They didn't have the authority to execute. And so the Sanhedrin proceedings had to give way to Pilate's authority. But something I want us to understand and appreciate. Jesus was up all night. He was up all night going through these mockeries, being beaten, spat upon, mocked. Up all night. First, at the break of days, he's appearing before the Sanhedrin. They make the charge quickly. He's speaking blasphemy. He's saying he is the Son of God, equal to God himself. And so we must have him executed. But they know that they don't have that authority. And so they go before Pilate. Still early on Friday morning, he's moved to Pilate's court, perhaps at the castle of Antonia, beside the Jerusalem temple. Now, Pontius Pilate served as governor of Judea from AD 26 to AD 36. He was also appointed by the Roman Empire as the procurator of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea in AD 26. He was extremely offensive to the Jews. His soldiers carried standards bearing the likeness of the emperor into Jerusalem. He took money from the temple treasury to build an aqueduct into Jerusalem. He put golden shields inscribed with portraits of the emperor in Herod's palace. He was despised by the Jews, but it was to Pilate that these Jewish religious leaders are bringing Jesus, wanting him to give the sentence that Jesus would be executed. King Herod Agrippa charged Pilate with corruptibility, violence, robberies, ill treatment of the people, grievances, continuous executions without even the form of a trial, endless and intolerable cruelties. And it's to this man that Jesus is brought before. His official residence was in Caesarea on the Mediterranean seacoast, but due to the large crowds that have assembled in Jerusalem for the Passover feast, he is there to help maintain order with his troops. He's brought to the Praetorium, simply the name of the official residence of the Roman governor, the place of his judicial seat. And the Jewish leaders know that their religious laws mean nothing to a Roman official. So they have to come up with charges that will resonate with Pilate, the Roman governor, the procurator, that will cause him to look into this situation and come up with that death penalty. There are three charges that they bring against Jesus. Luke 23, verse 1. The whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting or subverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Subverting the nation, secretly trying to ruin or destroy the government, or to make it weaker or less effective. This was vague at best. The second charge is flatly false. In fact, Jesus taught, "Render to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar." But it was this third charge that he is claiming to be the Christ, a king, that would gain Pilate's attention as a ruler in the Roman government. Luke 23, verse 3, Pilate asked Jesus, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered and said, "It is as you say." John gives us more information that Jesus explains something about the nature of his kingdom. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." And it appears that Pilate realizes Jesus is no threat to his power. He can find nothing worthy of death in Jesus. In fact, he says to the chief priests and the crowd, verse 4, "I find no fault in this man." And you'll find some similar words three times in our text in Luke chapter 23. "I find no fault in this man." He doesn't want to execute Jesus. In fact, there's four attempts that he makes to avoid rendering judgment upon Jesus. The first one is simply, it's a matter of your law. You see to it. But they're insistent. So we'll see three more times that he wants to try to dismiss, to avoid making judgment in the case of Jesus. But when he says, "I find no fault in this man," the Jewish religious leaders erupt. They say, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." And when Pilate heard Galilee, he thought of another way that he might be able to avoid rendering judgment. Because Herod Antipas was the ruler over Galilee. So we read in the next verse, verse 6, "When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time." So Pilate thought, "I can get away from it now. I'll send him to Herod. Let him deal with Jesus." And so Jesus goes before Herod. This is still Friday morning. Herod Antipas was the same Herod who beheaded John the Baptist. One writer describes him as a playboy prince who was more interested in amusement and indulgence than in administering justice. And with that background, we see that this is the same approach that he takes to Jesus. He's not interested in justice. He's heard of Jesus. He's heard that Jesus does these tricks. He's hoping he'll see Jesus do one. Verse 8, "When Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but Jesus answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. So while Herod is trying to take a look at Jesus, anticipating some miracle, here are these enemies of Christ saying he needs to be executed. He is subverting the nation. He's telling folks not to pay taxes. He is claiming to be a king. He's not a friend to Caesar. But Jesus doesn't say a word. And fitting his character, Herod provides his own entertainment. Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt or ridiculed him and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous, elegant robe, and sent him back to Pilate. Perhaps this robe was a discarded royal garment that mocked the notion of Jesus as king. He's just playing, finding amusement. The trials of Jesus show the wickedness of man, but the gracious heart of God. The only good thing that came out of Pilate sending Jesus to Herod was verse 12. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other. Apparently, there's some quarrel between them, but by Pilate referring Jesus to Herod, Herod apparently was appreciative of that, was complimented by that. So that quarrel was mended. But now here's Jesus, back before Pilate again. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You've brought this man to me as one who misleads the people, and indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man." Second affirmation of Jesus' innocence. "I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him. And indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him." Jesus does not deserve to be executed, he say. "I will therefore," here's the third attempt to avoid executing Jesus. "I will therefore chastise him and release him." And what he was referring to was that scourging that we'll have to talk about another time. "But I will punish him. He's done nothing worthy of death, but I will punish him and then release him." They're just agitated, offended by this suggestion. So Pilate tries one more thing. Still trying to free Jesus, Pilate thought to grant his annual Passover favor of releasing a prisoner to them. It was a custom at the Passover feast. And so Pilate gives this angry mob a choice between Jesus and Jesus Barabbas. "Which one do you want me to release to you?" Barabbas. Verse 19 tells us that Barabbas had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. And Pilate was sure that the Jews would not want Barabbas released. He was a robber, John 18:40, a murderer and an insurrectionist. Now, I'd like to think that he selected the worst criminal he could find. "Which one of these do you want me to release to you? The worst of the worst criminals or Jesus in whom I find no fault?" Thinking surely they would ask for Jesus. But it may just be that many would view Barabbas as a hero, leading an insurrection against the Roman government. Perhaps the one that he had murdered was a Roman soldier. We don't know. But we do know how they feel about Jesus. So the cries went up for the release of Barabbas. They all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man, away with Jesus, and release to us Barabbas." Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, but they shouted, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him. I will scourge him and let him go." So Pilate gave sentence. The conclusion is, in verse 24, that it should be as they requested. He's caving in to their demands. He released to them the one they requested, Barabbas, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison. But he delivered Jesus to their will. Matthew tells us that when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude. You see, the last thing Pilate needed was a Jewish uprising in Jerusalem during the Passover. He knew he would be held accountable, so he says, I've got to defuse the situation. I'm going to wash my hands of this man and say, you see to it. I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. You see, Pilate was a compromiser who was willing to content the people. So Barabbas was released, and Jesus was condemned to die on a Roman cross. A man guilty of murder and who deserved the death penalty under law was released. And the innocent man bore the penalty that he deserved. Did Barabbas have a clue? Have you thought about that? Did Barabbas have a clue? When he went home to his family, if he had one, did he realize that when Jesus was going to the cross, it should have been him? When he was released from prison, no more chains about his ankles and his wrists, and saw Jesus bound with that cross as he carried the cross to Golgotha, did he stop and think, that should have been me? When Barabbas looked at the rest of his life with the prospect of living until he died from old age, did he at once, even for a moment, think that Jesus, as a man of about 30 to 33 years of age, would be ending his life when it should have been Barabbas? I don't have a picture of Barabbas, but I could show you one. I could show you my picture. I could show you a picture of yourself. We are Barabbas. We are the ones who committed the crimes. We are the ones who have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We are the ones who deserve to go to the cross. But Jesus, even though this mockery of trials and even the crucifixion itself would show the wickedness of man, it was also showing the gracious heart of God. So Jesus went in the place of Barabbas. But not just Barabbas. He went in your place. He went in mine. You and I are Barabbas. And on the cross, he died not only so Barabbas could be set free, but he died in our place so that we might have forgiveness and so that we might live. How will you respond to that incredible love? It may be that you're ready this morning to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, to have that opportunity to have that blood that was shed on the cross applied to your life so that your sins and my sins that caused us to be worthy of the cross can be washed away. Because Jesus went in our place. It may be that you need the prayers of the church as you desire to come back home. If you're subject to the invitation, Please come right now as we stand and sing.